Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. I'm Sean Crawford. This week we'll learn about the Women's Professional Baseball League. The new league has launched in Springfield, playing all of its games in the capital city this year. We'll hear from fans and players, including one who overcame physical challenges to live her dream. We'll talk about what it may take for the league to be a long-term success. The U of I is still debating if the Urbana-Champaign campus should have a mascot. The U of I retired its symbol Chief Illiniwek 2 decades ago. Data centers are controversial, but they can result in a windfall for local communities. We'll focus on 2 towns and find out if the money is worth it. We'll examine the conditions at county juvenile detention facilities. And this week in Illinois history, looks back at an inventor and his work in developing the telephone. That and more coming up on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. We'll talk about the Women's Professional Baseball League. That's still ahead. But first, money is the driving force behind data centers across the country. They are very profitable, and some of that cash is flowing to communities right here in Illinois. Ben Howell reports on the revenue experience of 2 cities.
The city of DeKalb in northern Illinois has hosted a data center operated by Facebook parent company Meta for 4 years now. Amid cornfields south of the city, the facility has operated with little to no trouble. In fact, money from the facility has made a positive difference. City Manager Bill Nicholas says property tax money collected from Meta has been transformational.
In the first 4 years, the total tax benefit in direct dollars, actual dollars to all the local taxing bodies has been around $72 million.
The local school district receives most of that money. Nicholas says in DeKalb that breakdown is roughly 60% to the schools and about 8% to the city. The city does point to the new Leroy A. Mitchell Elementary School as evidence of what data center revenues can do for an entire community. The school opened a year ago.
We try to have neighborhood schools so we don't have to do a lot of busing, but there was our most densely populated neighborhoods are on our northwest side, and there was no neighborhood school there.
Nicholas says the school's price tag of $34 million was roughly the same as 3 years of Meta's property tax contribution to the school alone. Superintendent of the DeKalb Community School District, Billy Huermo, says money from Meta sped up the process of getting the school, but it's not accurate to say they essentially paid for it.
Very conservative with our numbers to ensure that we have a healthy fund balance, and even our board has agreed to a 20 to 30% fund balance minimum because we don't want to be in a spot where we can't pay our bills.
Huermo says the DeKalb School District is an example of another benefit, property tax relief. He uses the analogy of pizza.
Although 6 pieces of those are for us, we've left a couple behind. It doesn't mean the other taxing bodies can't eat those up if they wanted, but we've left some behind so that to eliminate that on the burden on our taxpayers.
Huermo says data centers kept the school district from needing to raise property taxes. Huermo says the presence of Meta and other new industry means residents are no longer the primary property taxpayers to the district.
By a lot, but now with the new industry, we've been able to shift more of what we utilize from industry and not as much as residential.
The resident share of the school tax pie has fallen from more than half to about 30%. DeKalb City Manager Bill Nicholas says data center community benefits are more than just property tax money. The land the Meta facility sits on was bought 2 decades ago. It was formerly agriculture, but had not been farmed since then. For those who worry about taking farmland out of production, Nicholas says this.
We're not out of corn. We're not out of farmland. County is 93%, 92% ag.
Others in the state are not as quick to find large projects or new programs to fund with data center money. In Aurora, city officials described their approach to data center revenue as cautious. The money collected goes into the city's general revenue account. Aurora uses it for administration, maintenance, public safety, and other routine expenditures. Allison Lindberg, Aurora's sustainability director, says the city is hesitant to allocate data center money to pay for big capital projects.
We've had concerns, not just as city employees, but our citizens are concerned about counting on this revenue for too long. We don't know what the future of data centers is going to look like. We've heard things about concerns with a bubble.
Lindberg says the city feels it has to think about the possibility the centers could leave Aurora for a different site. The centers pay the city a utility tax based on how much power the centers use from the grid.
if they don't actually use as much energy as we had expected them to use, and then we're counting on that revenue, that's something that the city then has to consider.
Dollars don't matter for everyone. With the rise of a national pushback against data centers, local politics may beat the prospect of development and revenue. Aurora Mayor John Lash says despite city revenue growth from data centers, residents tell him $1 million isn't worth their peace of mind. WNIJ's Peter Medlin contributed to this report. I'm Ben Howell.
The Women's Professional Baseball League kicked off their inaugural season in Springfield last weekend, and despite a forecast that brought showers all day, over 4,000 fans from all over the country packed the rain-soaked stadium, wearing thin ponchos and cheering not only for the women playing, but also for the league to succeed as a whole. Bawa Iqbal was among the spectators in the stands.
It's game time as Monet Davis with the Los Angeles Queen steps up to the plate. She's facing off against New York Heights pitcher Rakyung Kim with a national audience watching on ESPN. And the first pitch is a strike.
There's a swing and a miss. It'll like tap in. We're just stepping right into history here.
On the next pitch, Davis hits a grounder to shortstop, who bobbles, and Davis makes it to first base, the first base runner in league history. A few minutes later, Queens catcher Jamie McKay hits a fly ball, marking the first out of the game. Both teams came stacked with powerhouse players, like former Little League star Davis for the Queens and Japanese pitcher Ayami Sato for the Heights, who's considered to be one of the best pitchers in the world. Davis says she was buzzing with excitement after the sold-out opener.
This team, even though we've been together for such a short amount of time, they hold a special place in my heart.
Fans from all over the country, Ohio, D.C., and even California, traveled to Springfield to witness the star-studded lineup. And quite a few of them came wearing Rockford Peaches uniforms, bubblegum pink dresses with bright red ball caps and knee-high socks. The Peaches were one of the first formal professional women's baseball teams. Founded during World War II, the team won four league championships and were famously depicted in the 90s sports movie A League of Their Own. '99-year-old Maybelle Blair was rolled out onto the field in her wheelchair to throw a ceremonial pitch. One of her former teammates, 91-year-old outfielder Gloria Rogers, was also at the game, rooting for the Queens.
These girls, they're really competitive, very, the whole thing. But I think it's wonderful and it's great. I hope people can see that and that they're going to want to pay to get into the games.
Brenda Pablo of Kentucky wore a peach uniform to the game. She says she got teary-eyed seeing the original Peaches on the field.
It was amazing, and it's like meeting a hero that I didn't know I had.
9-year-old Lena Shackelford and her mom, Rachel, traveled from Virginia to watch New York Heights' Danae Benitez play. Shackelford came to Saturday's game decked out in royal blue Heights gear. She had participated in a catching practice with Benitez in D.C. 2 years ago. As she watches Benitez warm up on the field, Shackelford says she wants to be just like her one day.
There's only like two times I've been in a tournament that's all girls. So I'm kind of used to being the only one. So it feels really great to know that other people are out there.
Benitez would go on to hit the season's first home run during the bottom of the fourth inning.
That home run by Danae Benitez, our first home run of the season.
But in the end, the Queens reigned victorious.
Total score is for tonight's ball game. Queens. 10 runs, 10 hits, no errors.
10-8 in a game that had been close up until the final inning. But the game doesn't end here. Among the out-of-towners were many local supporters. Carol Corgan, Jill Grove, and Susan Falpel grew up in the 1960s and 70s. They either played in girls' softball leagues or in the sandlots with the other neighborhood kids. Falpel says she feels good about promoting a league that she hopes will go far.
And I want those women out there to know that we want them to go on to bigger and better things, and they deserve to. So thank you for gracing us for 1 year, and, you know, let's go, ladies.
The season runs through early September. I'm Mawa Iqbal.
Women have been part of baseball since the sport's earliest days. What might it take to make this league last? Violet Miller, a Chicago Sun-Times reporter and fan, talks more about it with Sasha Ann Simons.
So you're a baseball fan yourself. We've talked about this a couple of times, so I wonder how cool it was for you to cover this moment in history.
Oh, you guys can't get me to shut up about it, so I will keep going. But it was incredible. It was really, really amazing to be, you know, in such a historic moment. Some of the original players themselves also being there, you know, that day too. So
oh, that's wonderful.
Mabel Blair throwing out the first pitch, 99 years old. So really shows you, you know, how long it has been. There has been, of course, women's baseball in the interim.
Mm-hmm.
But this is, you know, a really, really important big push. I mean, it's being broadcast on ESPN. This is going to be, you know, pretty huge. So
yeah.
I'm excited.
So you were there for the big day, for the opening day game in Springfield. I mean, what was the vibe?
It was, I mean, people were electric. It was cold. It was rainy. Like, everyone thought they were going to call the game, and yet they played on, which was incredible. And it really shows the level of excitement for this league. You know, folks were, again, sticking out the rain, you know, watching this back and forth, a late comeback by the L.A. Queens to take over the New York Heights. You really couldn't have asked for a better game for opening day.
Well, you say it was electric. I want to give folks a sense of what the action sounded like.
This ball is launched into center field, going back all the way, running, trying to race after it is Davis. She slips, falls. Here comes the runs. One, two, and it's a tie ball game. And there she smashes one over the head of Davis. That is gone. The first home run here in WPBL history.
I mean, could you hear anything around you for that first home run? Sounds like the screams were super loud.
It was incredible. I mean, again, sold out, packed house. There were a lot of people there. And so, you know, again, people were just excited. Of course, they're cheering for their teams. You know, people are just excited to see baseball play. They're excited to see women playing baseball.
WBEZ's senior statehouse reporter Mawa Iqbal was there, too. And she talked with a 9-year-old. Her name's Lena Shackelford. She's a fan from Virginia, and she came to cheer on the New York Heights.
There's only like 2 times I've been in a tournament that's all girls. So I'm kind of used to being the only one. So it feels really great to know that other people are out there.
Aww.
That's really cute.
The next
There's
generation.
A lot of that. Yeah.
A lot of kids.
Lots of kids excited in jerseys. And the players have been sticking around, you know, at the events, signing things, really engaging that next generation, making sure that they have people to, you know, look up to and just really, you know, invigorating the kids in terms of, you know, bringing them in, making them part of it.
I love that so much. I mean, I mentioned earlier, Violet, we had another women's pro baseball league called the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League. It started in Chicago in 1943. It went on to inspire the film, A League of Their Own. I mean, I remember that movie in real time coming out as a kid. Like, I was the, you know, well, I was like 9 or 10, but I was the kid. I was the little Lena looking at that movie thinking, this is awesome, right? Women in such a powerful position. I had never really seen it in real life on the professional level. Just us kids playing, you know, amongst ourselves at the parks.
And there really hadn't been up until that point. I mean, the league ran from, you know, 43 to 54, starting at Wrigley Field with those tryouts. Of course, the scene that, you know, everybody's seen in the movie, except me. I need to watch it.
Yes, it's
so good. I've seen the 2022 show, so I'm caught up.
Okay,
you know?
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, it really incredible just to have that history, because that 90s movie did create another push. There was a short-lived league in the late 90s, 97 to 98. That also, you know, just kind of petered out. But I mean, like you said before, women have been a part of history, baseball history, for as long as there's been baseball.
How was it perceived back then? You know, when you go back to the early days of women's professional baseball, were people catching on? Was it, you know, was it popular?
A lot of it wasn't covered, so it's hard to tell. There isn't a lot of recorded history on, you know, some of this, but there are historians who have, you know, gone in depth on this. I mean, you've got the Dolly Vardens in the late 1800s. You've got the St. Louis Black Broncos. A lot of these teams were, you know, they were essentially amateur professional shopping themselves around to play other teams to try and get those games because it was so difficult. But obviously very different. Even in that, you know, 40s and 50s league, I mean, they were going to charm school. Skirts were a part of the uniform. Mm. There were a lot of these, you know, really entrenched gender norms being instilled in this, whereas, you know, the league today, it's just plain baseball.
Mm. Yeah, so what you just sort of described is, like, despite breaking these gender barriers, the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League was still kind of reflecting the times.
Unfortunately, yeah, very much so. And that, I mean, that didn't stop the women who were a part of that from playing, you know, their best baseball. There were some really, really incredible players. But obviously, you know, it is a very different opportunity for the players today.
We just had the WNBA All-Star Weekend, of course, a couple weekends ago. That drew a pretty big crowd here to Chicago. ESPN just announced that it's going to be bringing, as you said, the full season of the WPBL, which is exciting. Does that overall support feel a little bit different?
The proliferation of the WNBA, the PWHL, you know, all of these different professional women's leagues, specifically, I mean, in every sport has always traditionally been like women have been pushed out of it. And so, you know, all of these leagues had something to struggle against. But I think with baseball, there's something unique in that there is also softball, and people often, you know, even still the players are getting questions of why aren't you just playing softball? And a lot of them have, because that's where the economic opportunity in college was. But these are two very different sports, and
right.
People need to realize they're different sports. And so I think with the WNBA, the PWHL, their success, I think, has really paved a path for the WPBL to, you know, shine in its own right now.
Yeah, I want to get used to that acronym, WPBL. what else do you think, before I let you go, Violet, you know, the Women's Baseball League needs in order for it? Because we want it to grow. We want it to prosper, right? This can't be it.
Yeah, I think people just have to tune in, you know, simply watching. I'm a fan of baseball. I will watch any baseball that's being played, so I, you know, love to see it, obviously.
And I feel like we can take lessons from some of the other women's leagues, too, right?
Absolutely.
You've seen the WNBA grow tremendously over the years. I remember a time when literally nobody was watching, right? And it grew from there, right? A lot of awareness has come since, and just kind of putting better eyes on the fact that women are playing and they're doing a darn good job.
Yeah, and accessibility is really important. I mean, you see the PWHL was, you know, free to stream for its first season.
Mm-hmm.
I still believe it is in some ways. So the WPBL, you know, they're streaming it free internationally on YouTube. It's, you know, behind the ESPN paywall that you can still get it through scripts on like Roku and some other channels for free.
Yeah.
So I think accessibility is a big thing. Just making sure that you're opening yourself up to these fan bases because, you know, as you said, the player base is there.
Violet Miller of the Chicago Sun-Times discussing the Women's Pro Baseball League. Still to come, we'll hear from a player who has overcome a lot to get on the field. This is Statewide. And we're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. The inaugural season of the Women's Professional Baseball League is making history. The league is playing all of its games this season in Springfield. For the Los Angeles Queens outfielder and pitcher, Brittany Apgar, it's the realization of a dream she refused to abandon. Born without her right hand, she underwent multiple surgeries as a child and later worked with Shriners Children's Hospital to discover a prosthetic that helped her swing a bat. Even when others questioned whether the prosthetic gave her an unfair advantage, Brittany refused to let adversity define her, instead finding new ways to compete and excel. She and league executive William Moss say Springfield was chosen because of its baseball history and enthusiastic community support, with Robin Roberts Stadium the location for the first season. The two talked with Randy Eccles.
Brittany, you got drafted by the Queens. It was like third round, so pretty high draft pick. And that draft was not just Americans. See people worldwide on these rosters.
14 countries are represented in our league.
Congratulations
on
that.
So
and sounds like you've been working hard to get there.
Got to be.
William, for those who don't have the picture, there's been lots of coverage. I hope most people have heard about it. Springfield has this unique opportunity to host the first season of the WPBL. Tell us a little bit about how that came about.
Women's professional baseball returning after 70 years. We're really happy and thrilled to be here in Springfield. The history of Springfield and Robin Roberts Stadium in particular, having hosted a number of teams over the years, including the Springfield Sallies of the original Women's Professional Baseball League, made it an easy decision for us. We've been really lucky to find partners in the Lucky Horseshoes and Jamie Toole and his wife Melissa Gaynor in particular to welcome us with open arms. The Shoes finished their last game on the 26th, and we were here the night of the 26th, and in the process of turning the stadium around. We needed a professional stadium in a market that we believe could support the league. We sold out Saturday and Sunday. All signs are pointing towards that hypothesis proving to be true.
How many games are there in the season for the Queens, for instance? How many will you play?
So we have 3 games a week running through the end of August, and then playoffs will start in September.
Very accessible for the community. Tickets start at $22 and can go up from there. A lot of great opportunities to see our incredible athletes and enjoy history literally in the making.
We'd love to have all sellouts for all those games to get you launched the nice
way. I like
way.
The way you think. Yeah, sir.
So, Brittany, you had 3 months to get ready for this when you found out this was an opportunity. How did you get ready?
3 months is a short amount of time when it comes to conditioning your body. And I have been 4 years removed from a sport competitively. I played in college and then left college. I knew that going into these tryouts, I would be facing professional leaguers in other countries. I would be facing D1 athletes from our own country. And then we have a group of girls that play with the Savannah Bananas as well. So I knew that I needed to train 10 times harder than what they were doing currently just to even get in shape. I worked a full-time job at the time getting ready. My days looked like I would usually get up around 6 a.m., do footwork drills and mile run to warm up, go to work at 9, work until 3, which was my lunch break, meet up with some friends at 3. We would run another mile with weighted vests, so it usually was like 20 to 40 pounds. We'd switch on and off. After work, my job ended around 7, so I would drive over to my parents' house. My dad would throw me batting practice in the cages until the sun went down, even though he just got off of work at the factory. After that, I worked at a 24-hour gym. So I would go back to the gym, work out with my best friend who is a college wrestler, because in my personal opinion, there's no one in better shape than a wrestler. They are conditioned down to their fingertip. We would get a workout in. He would not let me leave that gym until I could do everything. Even if I was in tears, crying, he believed in me and he believed in this sport that he pushed me, and I needed that. After wrestling, another one of my good friends, he played college baseball. He was able to get me into the college facilities so we'd be able to hit batting practice until about 12. Sometimes we didn't at like 11, but sometimes we didn't at midnight.
Hit the cages,
huh? That's right.
4 years is a long time for any athlete.
Yes.
During that time, were you still playing or working out a little bit? And yeah. You just had to get real serious?
I do enjoy working out in general. I just like being in shape. I worked out in a lifting weights aspect, but I don't think that lifting weights always correlates to athletic strength. I was really strong as a girl, but throwing a baseball was a lot different. And because of those weightlifting, my form got locked into a singular plane. Pitching is a lot harder for me now because my chest is too strong, stronger than my back. Finding that fine tune between every muscle category that gives me the best ability to play competitively.
Weightlifting might not set you up for the overall throw.
Yeah, exactly.
What positions do you play?
So I am center fielder and I'm also a pitcher.
So you do both, sort of an Ohtani of the WPBL, right?
Yeah.
There we go. Bat, are you a switch hitter?
So I can switch it. In softball, I would switch it because drag bunting gets me closer to first. My big thing is I love stealing bases. I am the speed. If we have home run hitters, which LA guys pop out to LA games, we have all the home run hitters. We're stacked. So those one run home runs are going to turn into 2 run home runs. I know my job, so I just got to get on base for them.
Well, you got great looking brands for the teams too. You got your Queen stuff on right now for LA. How does that work out with the teams being elsewhere? Are you having a sense that fans are going to come in from those markets to see some of the games?
Yeah, what we've seen up to this point has been very much that people are coming from far and wide. We have a lot of fans that have actually asked us, assuming that we were going to be in their local markets and wanting to buy home tickets or what have you, remind them, please see our women up close and personal in Springfield. We've had actually fans, Australia, Japan, Korea, that have wanted to buy tickets and come see our athletes play as well. So it's been quite a global reach.
Excellent for the league, but also great opportunity for Springfield to have some folks come and check out the town. Brittany, back to you about baseball. I mean, how competitive does this league feel to you? You played college. That was sort of the apex of baseball for women, right? But now you've got this pro league and looks like a wide level of talent coming in. How's it feeling?
It's such an incredible feeling to know that everyone here is the best of the best. Being okay or being decent is not going to get you on that starting roster. Everyone here is going to play every single game as much as they can and prove their spot continuously. That's just the athlete mindset. And it's really cool because a lot of these women that we're playing with now, we've grown up playing together, just because women's baseball wasn't that big. You know, back in 2013, we were still trying to even be accepted as playing baseball and not being pushed into softball. Being here with all of the women, it's like at the hotel, we're all friends. We get to hang out, you know, go to cookouts and stuff. And then on that field, we are competitors true and through. But because we know each other so well, it's very hard to manipulate the game into your favor, because the other players like the back of your hand. And especially after the games end in the playoffs, you're going to see some competitive ball. It's not going to be a blowout.
You mentioned softball. You did play a little bit of softball.
I did.
Share with us what you worked through with the Shriners and how the challenges appeared.
Yeah, so a little backstory about me. I don't know if I've said it yet. I was born without my right hand. The doctors use the term hypoplasia. It just means that organs or something in your body didn't form right. Typically, it's in the brain. So typically, there's a deformity in the brain. But mine was a physical missing my right hand. Before the age of 3, I had 12 surgeries to lengthen my arm and to give me fingers. My parents used the philosophy of more of a length of an arm would give me a closer to a normal life. Being able to tie shoes, it's a very simple task most people don't think twice about. For someone just going into preschool, that could be why you don't fit in with the other kids, because you can't tie your shoes yet. From a young age, my parents really, they never let me use my hand as an excuse. I think that's why I fell in love with baseball so much, because it was such a challenge at a young age, and I love a challenge. Growing up playing rec ball until about the age of 10, it was fine to swing with one hand because we're all just kids learning how to play the form of the game. When you start getting into your teenage years and getting more serious about your love of the game, people start getting a lot stronger, a lot quicker. I noticed that I was falling behind in my bat, so to catch up to them, I knew I had to be fast. Eventually, the other teams will learn that and just play in on you. So if you put the ball on the ground, they can still throw you out. So I knew I needed to get lift into the outfield. The Shriners Hospital was just incredibly generous with how they treat kids, how they accept everyone. My parents, we've never grown up with money, so getting a prosthetic is something that's like a dream for a kid like me. And the Shriners, they do everything for free. It was my first shot at being able to swing with a two-handed swing. So the Greenville, South Carolina Shriners Hospital, they had me out when I was 12, 13, and they constructed a prosthetic that allowed me to swing with two hands. Unfortunately, around that time, a lot of the tournaments would say that that enhances my swing, that gives me an unfair competitive advantage. And in my personal opinion, of course someone with two hands is going to say that. It made me feel more different than just swinging with one hand. So I stopped using it the higher and the older I got, just because I ran into so many problems with it. But every time I would run back, and my prosthetist, her name was Chrissy, she would treat me like a normal kid. She never treated me like she was making a prosthetic. She was trying to fix my swing so that I could play as competitively as I could, instead of focusing on the fact that I was disabled. She said, "What do you need to make you feel like an athlete?" And it was there.
Do you have a different sort of swing grip because of the one hand, or is it more like a tennis sort of?
Yeah, I actually have multiple different swings. It really depends on the situation of the game. I hit the ball on the ground and I can beat that throw to first base. So if we need a runner, I might go to the left-hand side of the box and put down a bunt. Or if we need a lift into the outfield, I'll use a prosthetic that allows me to, it's handling the force of when the ball impacts the bat that really messes me up. So my prosthetic allows me to catch that force and then replicate it back to the ball.
A lot of things that a lot of people don't have to worry about, but you figured it out. And Now here you are in the first season of the Women's Professional Baseball League. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, a lot of hard work takes it for any athlete. You talked about the prosthetic. It wasn't like it was somehow enhancing. It wasn't bionic or increasing strength. It was just to give you grip, right?
All it did was hold the bat and like allowed me to, when you swing and come down, you have wrist flexion. That's the one thing I don't have with my nub. So that just allowed me to replicate the two-handed wrist motion.
What's going to be going on in your head as you hit the field for the first time professionally?
My parents are driving up from North Carolina. I never thought that I would be able to hear them cheer for me in the stands again. The fact that I am 22 years old and I get to say that my parents are coming to watch me play baseball, my friends are coming to watch me play baseball, and little girls now, they can say, "I want to play professional baseball," without having to create an own path for themselves. Like, we are going to do that for them. All we need them to do is dream bigger than we were able to, so that this world just keeps getting kinder.
How did your passion of baseball rise? Do you follow pro baseball or did you love League of Their Own, any of that?
Yeah, this question always makes me laugh because I don't watch sports that much. I honestly don't do much TV, don't do much Instagram. I like just being out in public. So seeing people in my community really be passionate about sports, all different types. I didn't just play baseball when I was a kid. I tried everything, soccer, basketball, tennis. If there was a ball and some competition involved, even track, I kept coming back to baseball because of how mental the game is. You truly don't have to be the strongest there to win a ball game. You just have to know your role and be able to play a strategy to a game. If you can get the other team to play at your momentum, then you've got the momentum for the whole game. I think that it's such a cool way to, like, I like pushing my body, so there's the 10% aspect there, but I love using my mind to work around things, and it's just the challenge there. It's always, like, made my heart feel full.
We appreciate both of you coming in to share what this season is going to be like. Walking out, Brittany, what do you hope is left behind for perhaps some of those young girls or other folks who come to the games?
I hope that if you don't like watching baseball, if you give us one shot, that you will like watching baseball. Watching women's baseball is completely different from watching other sports. We have lived our whole life not knowing that this was going to be a possibility, but playing to the highest extent. And so the competition, the energy, and everything that's going to be brought to this game is going to be something that you'll feel when you leave the stadium.
It's a really exciting time for sports to see women being able to get, whether it be soccer or the WNBA, getting the opportunity to play at the same level that all the other major professional sports has been really great. I mean, you've seen WNBA in the past year grow and get some real player compensation wins and things like that. William, what's the hope for the future of the WPBL?
Growth, success, and reaching more people throughout the country and showing them the incredible talents that our players and athletes have and bringing women's pro baseball to all corners of our country.
Do you hope next year that the teams will be playing in their home markets and maybe a couple expansion teams?
That's a good question. I think we have to prove ourselves this season and really understand where we can improve. There's no doubt the success has already been proven by having our athletes here and our players here. The future is bright. The question would be, what does growth look like for us and what is our strategic plan for growing? Expansion teams for sure would be in discussion. We'd love to be in our home team markets. And then we'll see how from there, what does it look like for the season? What does it look like for expansion teams? And we'll have a lot of exciting work to do at the end of September.
Women's Professional Baseball League executive William Moss and one of the founding players of the new league, Brittany Apgar. Look for the WPBL website. You can find more details about the league, including the league's schedule and how to purchase tickets.
Illinois is signing on to two new multi-state lawsuits against the Trump administration, Isabella Nieto reports.
Illinois Attorney General Kwame Raoul has joined several other states' attorneys general in suing the federal government over new policy changes. One lawsuit challenges the recently increased tariffs on more than 80 countries. It's the third time Raoul has sued the federal government over tariffs. Another lawsuit challenges federal efforts to grant immigration officials access to sensitive private data of families receiving aid from the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program. Raoul says the policy change, quote, is a blatant and pretextual effort to politically target those who are lawfully receiving critical TANF benefits. I'm Isabella Nieto.
Welcome to This Week in Illinois History. I'm Clint Cargill. In his lab in Highland Park, Illinois, Elisha Gray developed prototypes of the telephone, the electronic music synthesizer, and other electric wonders. Born August 2, 1835 in Barnesville, Ohio, Gray attended Oberlin College, where he taught science and electricity classes but never graduated. In 1869, he and Enos Barton formed Gray and Barton Company, which supplied telegraph equipment to Western Union. They later moved the company to Chicago. Gray retired in 1874 to invent full-time. He created the first electronic music synthesizer by combining a small piano keyboard with electromagnetic circuits. The device sent notes by telegraph wire that were played by a speaker box connected at the other end. His first public demonstration was at Highland Park's Presbyterian Church on December 29, 1874. In 1877, he staged a concert in Philadelphia that played live via telegraph in New York City. On February 14, 1876, Gray's lawyer filed a caveat, an official intent to file a patent, for the telephone. A few hours later, Alexander Graham Bell's lawyers filed his patent application. While litigating over who filed first, Bell learned his invention would not work without some of the technology that had been included in Gray's filing. Bell allegedly copied Gray's idea, scribbling it into the margins of his own patent. After years of litigation, Bell won the telephone patent, but Elijah Gray's design is now credited as the first successful telephone prototype. I'm Clint Cargill, and that's This Week in Illinois History.
More ahead on Statewide. Stay right here. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. 20 years ago, the NCAA told the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign it could not bring out Chief Illiniwek at championship games. It said the fictional chieftain was hostile to indigenous communities. The U of I retired the chief, but it still has not picked a new mascot. Other schools have moved on. Native American faculty say the inaction is damaging the campus community. Emily Hayes reported on this subject earlier this year. We listen back to her story.
Students are lining up to take pictures with the Kingfisher. The 6-foot bird costume matches U of I school colors.
She's naturally true to the orange and blue.
Claudia Babel is a sophomore at U of I. She's the social media coordinator for the King's Guard, the student club pushing to make the belted Kingfisher the school's new mascot.
They're native to Illinois and North America, but Kingfishers are found all over the world, just like our students are.
During student elections in 2020, a majority supported the idea. Faculty and the University Senate followed soon after. But university spokesperson Pat Wade says U of I is looking for a new mascot that demonstrates it can bring the community together. And it hasn't seen one yet that clearly meets that standard. Meanwhile, the old athletic symbol persists. There are statues of the fictional Chief Illiniwek at some local bars. Babel says at sporting events, dads sometimes shout at the student in the Kingfisher costume. Native American students and faculty at U of I have called on the university to discard the old mascot for decades. The chief last appeared at a 2007 basketball game.
It's a halftime tradition going back 81 years. The marching Illini strike up the 3-1.
Students dressed as the mascot would wear a long feathered headdress and face paint. Supporters said the regalia honored Native Americans, but that wasn't how Native students and faculty saw it. Joseph Gaughan is a member of the Ani Gravant tribal nation in Montana and a professor at Harvard University. In the 90s, he was a PhD student at U of I.
We made the rounds and made all the arguments and offered the best rationales.
Research shows Native youth who are exposed to Native American mascots have shortened dreams and ambitions for their future. Gaughan and half a dozen other Native students believe they could educate the higher-ups on campus and get the Board of Trustees to eliminate the mascot.
Many of the people we talked to privately acknowledged that those rationales and arguments made sense to them, but that they were powerless to do anything.
It took a threat from the National Collegiate Athletic Association to push U of I to change. The school tried to appeal the policy on racist mascots twice and lost in April 2006. Political winds have shifted since that ruling 20 years ago. President Trump threatened to hold up the Washington Commanders' plans to build a new stadium last year if the team didn't revert to its previous name. And he has an ally in the Native American Guardians Association.
My mom always taught us to be very proud to be the real Redskins. And if anyone was going to be offended by being the Redskins, it would be my mom.
Becky Clayton Anderson is a president of NAGA. She's an enrolled member of the Hidatsa in North Dakota. She grew up in central Illinois and went to Sullivan High School, where the sports teams are the Redskins. The group has released statements and petitions in support of Trump. The Department of Education has supported NAGA's latest lawsuit.
We're one step away from the Supreme Court, where we will win, showing that people trying to eliminate Native American names and images is discrimination against a race.
Clayton Anderson says NAGA's next step is to go back state by state to make schools reinstate names and images like Chief Illiniwek. But many schools have moved on, and some administrators say they don't want to go back. Brad Bobo is Associate Athletic Director for Marketing at Arkansas State University. He's proud to have graduated from the school when the students were the Indians. But he says the old mascot had its own challenges.
You were so mindful about not being disrespectful
to Native Americans. You were a little bit handcuffed from a marketing and a licensing standpoint by what you could do with that nickname.
The NCAA listed Arkansas State among 18 universities with hostile mascots. When bigger schools lost their appeals, Arkansas decided to change. The sports teams became the Red Wolves, and Bobo says the new mascot didn't lead to any decline in alumni donations.
Even though you don't like being told you got to do something, changing, I would tell you, changing was the best thing for us.
Community members at U of I hope the school can take a similar step, because they say not having a new mascot continues to harm Native Americans on campus.
They could care less about us.
Jackie Rand is an American Indian Studies professor at the school and a citizen of the Choctaw Nation in Oklahoma. She says administrators still show hostility towards Native students and faculty.
They have letters from faculty in their offices that say, "This is very disturbing. I can't believe I have to work here in these conditions."
Rand was pushed out as vice chancellor of Native Affairs 2 years ago without much explanation. U of I spokesperson Pat Wade says student affairs and civil rights administrators are meeting now to advise the university's new chancellor about future directions for the role. Rand says the lingering presence of Chief Alinowick makes it hard to hire Native American faculty.
So instead of having like a legit real mascot, we've got this ghost mascot that just hovers.
In the meantime, the Kingfisher is ready to step up. Whether it's outside Memorial Stadium during a football game or celebrating the Illini's Elite Eight basketball win, the mascot is trying to unite the campus. I'm Emily Hayes.
Illinoisans with home and auto insurance will see more protections against unjustified rate hikes. Laws that were newly signed by the governor this week require insurance companies to justify increasing costs and allow the State Department of Insurance to object to rates that are excessive. Here's the governor.
When corporations honor those values of treating their workers and their customers fairly, government should be a willing and able partner. When they don't live up to those values, government has an obligation to step in and impose fairness.
The laws also prevent insurers from increasing costs to cover losses from out-of-state natural disasters. Those new protections won't take effect until next year. A former cop convicted of murdering an unarmed black woman in her Springfield area home won't be getting out of prison early. Sean Grayson was convicted of second-degree murder for fatally shooting Sonia Massey after she called 911 to report a potential prowler. Grayson is battling cancer and applied to get out of prison less than a year into his 20-year sentence. Donna Massey, Sonia's mother, tearfully testified before the State Prisoner Review Board against Grayson's release.
When he asked her, "Is there anything else we can do for you?" she said, "No, sir." And he followed her in the house. He should have left right then.
The state panel took 10 minutes before unanimously rejecting Grayson's bid last week. His legal team declined comment. Hundreds of Illinois kids are held in county juvenile detention centers while they wait for their court proceeding. In annual inspections, the state has found several of them don't meet state health, safety, and quality standards year after year. Whose job is it to get them into compliance? Peter Medlin reports.
This spring, Knox County's juvenile detention center, known as the Mary Davis Home, shut down after a multi-year legal case. The ACLU of Illinois accused the center of punishing kids with solitary confinement, locking them up in small cells for 23 hours a day. In sworn statements, teenagers described constant isolation and strip searches that made them feel hopeless and suicidal. Just a few years earlier, in 2023, across the state, Franklin County's juvenile detention center also closed down, also as a result of a similar ACLU lawsuit into solitary confinement. Now, in both cases, state audits first called out these dire conditions. Every year, reports from the Illinois Department of Juvenile Justice, or IDJJ, mark them non-compliant with state standards and listed recommendations. But every year, the problems persisted.
It's, you know, strange the way the law is in Illinois. So, you know, we conduct these inspections of the detention centers, but we really don't have any formal authority over, you know, detention centers or whatever to kind of like, you know, enforce like any improvements.
That's John Albright with the Department of Juvenile Justice. He's the person conducting those annual audits. And Kevin Fee is the legal director for the ACLU of Illinois.
The state does have the ability statutorily to bring suits in court to challenge conditions of these facilities, but it for whatever reason has elected not to do so. It's kind of fallen on groups like ours, like the ACLU, to step in and bring suit when we, you know, find through our investigation that the conditions are unconstitutional.
County juvenile detention centers are oddly not part of the Illinois Department of Juvenile Justice. They're operated locally by a combination of the county board and the chief judge of whichever circuit court holds jurisdiction, some of whom don't have much previous experience with juvenile detention. And at the end of the day, it's mainly up to them to ensure compliance. It also means, technically, county detention centers are part of the judicial system in Illinois, which makes them exempt from public oversight through the Freedom of Information Act. And Fee says there is no reason for that exemption.
You combine it with, you know, the appropriate secrecy and privacy concerns, confidentiality of the identities of minors, which makes it, you know, even more difficult to sort of get information about the reasons for confinement and sort of the even the identity of the youth. You have these facilities that are basically turned into kind of black boxes that are shut off from the outside world, from outside scrutiny.
The Administrative Office of Illinois Courts also oversees the facilities. They visit monthly and publish reports based on a different set of standards than the IDJJ, and they can also reimburse counties to help pay for detention center staff. And yet another state office investigates complaints filed by kids. And Fee says this is not how the system works in other states.
Somewhat unique for the oversight to be quite as decentralized and fragmented as it is in the state of Illinois. In a lot of states, there's more uniform oversight, you know, by a state agency.
Hundreds of kids, sometimes as young as 10 years old, are locked in these facilities. And through 2024, the Illinois Juvenile Justice Commission published monthly reports showing how many youth were housed at county centers, for how long, and why they were there. And in the last report from December of that year, there were over 400 youth across 16 centers. And the majority of youth were there for fewer than 3 days, but many stayed longer than a month. The most common reason was a failure to appear in court or violation of a release condition. The total number of kids in county detention centers has gone down in recent years. Patrick Keenan Devlin has seen it as a youth defense attorney. He's the executive director of the Evanston-based Moran Center for Youth Advocacy.
It's important, obviously, for the mental health of the child. It's critical to their outcomes because we know social scientific studies have proven that children that spend time in detention have much higher recidivism rates.
In last year's IDJJ reports, most facilities were non-compliant in at least one area, like discipline or education, and 8 of them had been non-compliant in the same area for multiple years running. LaSalle County's been non-compliant in education every year since the state started publishing reports online in 2022. And every year, the reports say they're required to hire a special education teacher. Chuck Goodwin is their director of court services, and he says that just this month, they were finally able to hire someone after at least 4 years.
It is frustrating. I mean, for all of us.
He says staffing is always a challenge.
You have to have someone with the right aptitude that is able to work with kids, that has patience, able to communicate.
In Will County, every year IDJJ recommends the detention center there mitigate their use of chemical agents, meaning pepper spraying kids at the center. And the reports say they're an outlier, using them 29 times in 2024 when most centers across the state don't use chemical agents at all. Their director of court services say they do comply with IDJJ standards, although IDJJ lists chemical agents under its areas of noncompliance and recommendation section. In Winnebago County, every year the center's been deemed noncompliant in discipline for confining youth due to low staffing, although it notes they've made substantial improvements. Debbie Jarvis is the director of court services, and she says every center is unique, so it's hard to say why some are non-compliant, but there are issues they all deal with.
When I speak to superintendents statewide, staffing has been one of the biggest struggles that all of them have had. There is high turnover, and there are gaps.
Jarvis says it has improved recently. The Administrative Office of Illinois Courts has approved more positions, which allows counties to front the cost of a new higher salary and then get that reimbursed by the state. And she says starting pay has also increased in many facilities. Kevin Fee with the ACLU of Illinois says that confining kids is always extremely fraught.
When you have lack of staffing, when you have lack of funding, it just exacerbates the problems that I think that you often see in attempts to incarcerate kids that are at this kind of crucial stage of their development.
And he says it's vital to consider child development. He says these kids are often talked about like they're adult prisoners.
Almost always lost just how young these kids are in many cases. I mean, when you sit across the interview room from an 11 or 12-year-old, it's brought into very stark relief really quickly the gravity of the situation that you're dealing with.
And regardless of staffing, Fee says it's fair to question if these centers should be used at all.
Listen to them talk about their lives. Listen to them talk about their challenges. Listen to them talk, frankly, about the circumstances that led them to be incarcerated in these facilities. If folks could do that, I believe that these facilities would likely cease to exist very, very quickly.
But he says since they do exist, detention centers have to take their responsibilities seriously and put youth in a position to thrive, not just while they're locked in the facility, but when they go home. I'm Peter Medlin.
We're out of time for Statewide. Thanks for being with us. Join us next week. We'll return with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. You can find us where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois, with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.